Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday. Coming up this hour, the danger of misinformation, especially as we head into a very contentious election year. University of Delaware professor Danigal Young will join us to talk about what drives so many people to fall into the trap of fake news online and how our own psychology is often exploited by politicians and people in power.
Very interesting discussion coming, and we are welcoming your comments. Where do you come across misinformation the most? Are you finding it harder to separate truth from fiction? Has anything helped you navigate these online traps? Call us. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
In just a few moments, we're going to talk about a fascinating story that gets into how we dye our clothes. Spoiler alert, it's going to get toxic.
Ooh, I like that one.
First, it's going to get political, Cherry.
Yes.
Let's do some stories today.
Yeah, well, President Joe Biden, Avi, is expected to hold his first campaign speech of 2024 on Friday. Mm-hmm. He chose a place near Valley Forge and is expected to touch on the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. The president is expected to warn voters that his leading GOP opponent, you know him, former President Donald Trump,
you know him,
presents an existential threat to American democracy. Now, originally he was going to speak on Saturday, but the event got moved because we thought we were going to have this snowstorm, but looks like it's going to be rain. There you go. But at this point, we don't know the exact location of the speech. It has not yet been disclosed, but sources hint that it could be at Montgomery County Community College, located in Bluebell. And of course, you know, the campaign chose this location because of some history there, where 250 years ago, George Washington united a disorganized alliance of militias to fight for democracy. Now, all of this is kicking off the campaign season. Yep. In 2 weeks, you have the Iowa caucuses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go back to 2020, which we all remember, a lot of people voted for President Biden because they did not want, you know, former President Donald Trump, yep, to have a second term.
Yep.
So he's hoping to sort of, you know, motivate voters again using that same type of logic.
Because he's had problems reuniting that coalition,
yes,
during his presidency, at, mm-hmm, least if you look at the polls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in some ways this is not surprising at all, right?
No,
Pennsylvania is a swing state. We,
mm-hmm,
know that. But also Philadelphia and the region has always been a rich backdrop for politicians to play off of when, mm-hmm, they make these types of speeches. And in fact, Biden was here, I think, in 2022 for a, mm-hmm, big speech about democracy and the threat to democracy at Independence Hall. You'll recall Obama came to Philadelphia on the campaign trail in 2008 and gave a landmark speech, mm-hmm, about race. And again, using the idea of the nation's independence and founding as part of that speech. And you know I love history, Cherry. Let me take it all the way
back. Break it down.
1861.
Mm-hmm.
On his way to Washington to be inaugurated, Abraham Lincoln stopped at Independence Hall and made a short kind of impromptu speech. But the last words of it are chilling when you think about what happened, mm-hmm, during his presidency. Lincoln said at Independence Hall, 1861, "I have said nothing but what I am willing to live by, and if it be the pleasure of Almighty God, die by."
Wow. And
here in Philadelphia.
There you go.
So a great legacy of political speeches here, mm-hmm, in Philly. And we'll see what Biden delivers coming up.
Yeah. And by the way, I should mention that on Monday, he's going to go to another swing state, South Carolina.
Yep.
To speak.
Well, not a, we
well,
call it a swing state.
Swing, it's kind of like a swing. It's a very important state for Biden.
For Biden specifically.
For Biden,
yes.
Specifically. He's going to be in Charleston speaking at the church where 9 people were killed in an anti-black mass shooting back in 2015. These are like back-to-back, you know, events, mm-hmm, to sort of rally the troops for Biden and get people excited about the 2024 election. So,
yeah,
we shall see.
Absolutely. Some news about traffic safety in our city. Legislation signed into law last month authorizes adding 5 new corridors and 5 new school zones to Philly's speed camera program. Plan Philly's Aaron Moselle has a story up about this right now. You can check it out, whyy.org. You'll recall that they started to pilot these speed cameras on Roosevelt Boulevard in Northeast Philadelphia, and they have been credited with helping to reduce speeding on that very dangerous and wide roadway. And now through some state enabling legislation, which you have to do in for these speed cameras, they're going to expand that program. It looks like maybe Henry Avenue, North Broad Street, Cobbs Creek Parkway, Kelly Drive. We're not quite sure yet, but it does seem like this idea is building some steam.
Yeah, it is. And why? Why expand these traffic cameras? Well, city data shows that at least 40 people died in hit and runs in 2023. That is more than double the total that was recorded in 2019. So this is a real issue here. There is some concerns, though, that these speed cameras are going to penalize drivers.
Some people think it's regressive.
They do.
Kind of like the way the soda tax is.
They do. But from June 2020 to November 2022, violations actually dropped 90% because it seems like you get one of those tickets, you learn really quickly, and you slow down, right? And so that's the hope is that, you know, by expanding these zones.
$150 is the greatest teacher in the world.
You get that tap. That's like you feel that little tap right there to hit your pockets.
They call it a nudge, I believe, in behavioral psychology. It's a nudge.
You know, you start tapping those brakes. You're like, oh, what's the speed look like? I'm not going to be going
fast. Start nudging
those
brakes. Absolutely.
Exactly. But people will get an opportunity to weigh in on the location. So this won't just happen. And city council has to, you know, vote and everything in order to get each of the location, the cameras installed. So there's going to be some you know, mechanisms put in place to make sure that the public does have a say.
From an engineering perspective, it's interesting to think about what type of stuff works best. Because the problem is that people drive too fast, and when they drive too fast, they kill people. So the question is it speed cameras and traps? Does that motivate people the most? Maybe that's in combination with those signs that just tell you how fast you're going, so you get immediate feedback instead of feedback a couple of weeks later about, you know, to make maybe give you a little shame. Maybe just the roads need to be narrowed, right? Maybe Roosevelt Boulevard just can't be as wide as it is. And maybe it's all of these.
And then people have to walk across. I mean, it's just it's so many elements. But something needs to be done. Too many lives need to be saved.
Absolutely.
Question, Avi.
Sure. Hit me.
Have you, I don't know if you put up holiday decor, but
I do.
Have you taken it down yet?
Part of it, because we got a garland this year that was made of actual pine. It wasn't synthetic. That thing shed like crazy. Had to take it down the next day. 26th, it was down.
Yeah, because it was everywhere. Yeah. Well, my deadline for taking down my holiday decor, MLK Day. So there
you go.
That's
your self-imposed
deadline.
Mine
is still up there. But if you're somebody that keeps a Christmas tree up way past the end of the season, there are some great ways to undecorate sustainably in our region. You can recycle your gift wrap, paper gift bags and tags, Christmas cards and more. But, you know, you got to remember if your wrapping paper is glittery or metallic, the city will not recycle them. You can save them or reuse them for next year.
We don't want the recycling to be too shiny.
Yeah, it can't be too shiny. Also, there's an organic market in Center City called Moms that will take your string lights, whether they work or not.
That's so cool.
You can give those in. And a fun one, Christmas trees, you can do the straightforward, sustainable thing and drop them off for free at one of the city's many recycling centers. Or you can feed them to the goats. The Philly Goat Project will turn your tree into snacks for goats.
Goats eat trees.
Apparently so. I mean, they're the Goat Project. They're digging, give them snacks.
All right.
So there you go. But you should check out the story. Asha Prihar wrote a great roundup of all the things you can do. You can check out that story of BillyFan.com.
I'm wondering if goats eat all types of trees or just Christmas trees.
What is their stomach lining made of?
Yeah.
I'm like, dude.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That's a splinter like waiting to happen. But anyway.
Maybe you get some splinters if you have hardwood floors. Is that a transition? I don't know. We're going to talk about some real estate
news.
You were
so good at that.
That wasn't that good.
You pulled that out of the summer.
That wasn't that good.
Go ahead.
So if you have some extra millions in the bank, maybe you win the Powerball, you can now buy the former home, the former penthouse of 76ers MVP Joel Embiid in Center City. It's really more Old City over on Walnut Street near Front. It's just went on the market. The price, Cherry?
A lot.
it's a lot. In this case, a lot is $5.5 million. Now, that's the asking price. You can bargain down from that, okay? Mm-hmm. It's a 1,000-square-foot rooftop penthouse. Did you check out the photos?
I did. It has a pool, a hot tub, an outdoor kitchen on the rooftop deck.
A really cool-looking pool, I have to say.
I want to have a party at Joel Embiid's house.
Formerly. He doesn't live there anymore.
That's true.
And it was a very cool residence, and we're going to pair this with a story that we saw in The Inquirer. Zillow came out with a list of the top priorities for people looking for real estate in Philadelphia in 2023 based on the keywords that they type into Zillow. And this is Philly specific.
Mm-hmm.
Number three on the list, central AC.
Need that central AC for these climate-warmed summers. You
absolutely
do.
Number two,
mm-hmm.
basement.
Oh.
People are always looking for basement. And number one, street parking.
Yeah. People, no, it's serious out here.
When people look for a home, I think the first thing they think about actually is their car.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the national data, this is not Philly specific, mm-hmm. the number one thing on the list is garage.
Garage.
Yeah,
that's
garage.
Right.
If you're British, I suppose.
So, that was a bad accent there.
So, anyways, I just thought that's interesting, right? That
it
sort
is.
Of cars are so primary in people's minds when mm-hmm. they shop for a home.
Yeah, very cool. I like that. And $5.5 million, you could hit the. By the way, Powerball,
like
you
could
hit it. You know, $35 million jackpot. You might be able to buy Joel Embiid's.
Oh, that's plenty. You got.
Oh, yeah.
You got millions to spare.
There you
that.
Go. There you go. So, from real estate to a fascinating new exhibit at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia, which traces the rise of synthetic dyes in the textile industry. Before the 19th century, most clothing dyes. They were natural, but the mid-1900s chemical dye was discovered and more vibrant greens, reds, and pinks became possible. But sometimes there was a deadly effect.
Hmm.
And Philadelphia was at the center of it all, giving birth to an entire chemical industry. WHYY News arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins looked into textile dyes, including toxic ones used in our region and their cultural and environmental impact. Peter, welcome back to Studio 2. It's good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
WHYY News's.
I know.
Arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins. There he is.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, so tell us about this big moment in the middle of the 19th century. And first, tell us what was going on before. How were clothes getting their
natural
color?
Dyes? Natural dyes
natural
were
dyes. Okay.
You have very limited palette. You could get indigo, which is blue. You can get madder, which is red, or you can also get red from a Brazil wood. You can use saffron to get yellow, and
that's it.
That's pretty much you can do simple variations of those. And the dyeing process was extremely laborious because you had to oxidize it, you had to dip it and oxidize, you had to ferment the dye for months. So it was possible to get not good colors, but it was if your color got stale, like if your favorite suit or your favorite dress fell out of, was last year's color and you want to be this year's color, you can't dye. A person of normal means, if you're wealthy, you can do anything you want, but a person of normal means couldn't change the color of their clothes.
Interesting.
And clothes.
And then what happened?
By accident, an 18-year-old chemist named William Perkin.
18 years old?
18 years old. He was tinkering around trying to, he was working with coal tar, which is a black sludge that comes out of the, it's a byproduct of coal processing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to get, he was trying to extract something from it. And he realized that all his test tubes turned mauve, the color, that kind of purplish color.
It's a nice color, mauve.
Which does not exist naturally. You can't dye anything naturally that color. The color doesn't actually, it exists very rarely in the natural world generally. I think you can find some flowers that are mauve-ish. But, and he decided to give up on what he was trying to extract and just go all in on dyes. And so mauve became this sort of hit color. Suddenly you could have a mauve dress and no one could have that before. And it launched a whole industry.
And you talked about the laborious nature of natural dyes, but synthetic dyes weren't as laborious. So
no.
Talk about how the creation of synthetic dyes sort of transformed fashion in that way.
It's quick, it's cheap, and you can make it, you can dial into any color, any shade of any color you want. I mean, with natural dyes, if you're really good, you can get certain shades. But with synthetic dyes, you can literally dial in what precise shade you want. You can do it repetitively. You can do it reliably.
Color explosion here.
Color explosion. And every
people
year...
People walking around with colorful outfits on, gloves, all kinds of stuff.
I mean, you see... I mean, they didn't get real nutty until, you know, late in the 20th century when you get, like, Barbie pinks. And the 60s fashion... really exploded with really crazy colors, day glow colors, colors that don't exist naturally anywhere in the world.
Far out, yeah.
You can really get psychedelic with it. And you see some of that in this exhibit. You have this Barbie pink women's suit and these sort of day glow underwear and stuff. It's couldn't do that before.
And quick follow-up to that because, you know, I'm thinking about the guy, the 18-year-old who invented. He's getting sludge from coal. So I'm assuming that can't be good for human beings to have this kind of stuff. So there were some negatives to dyes.
The discovery of synthetic dyes really launched the modern chemical industry. Really a petrochemical industry, because all the dyes that they were extracting came from petrochemicals, came from the byproducts of coal, byproducts of oil. And so, like Bayer Aspirin started out as a dye company. Novartis, who contributed to the COVID vaccine most recently, started out as a dye company.
Wow.
DuPont didn't start as a dye company. They started with fire and gunpowder. But they developed most major chemical companies at some point in their late 19th century. Got into the dye business,
and a lot of stuff was right here in Philly. Right, Philly
it was huge.
Philly was like a mecca for this type of industrial
activity. It was actually the largest. The city with the largest textile industry in the world.
Wow.
And at one point, about 60,000 people worked in the greater textile industry, and we're talking about not just clothes, but upholstery and anything fabric related, hats, the weaving of fabrics, the manufacturing of fabrics, the dyeing of fabrics. It was an enormous industry. We used to have it. They got civic with it. There used to be a wool week, a civic parade with floats where all these industries.
Like wool week, yeah.
I couldn't figure out if anyone was ever crowned the queen, wool queen. But I'm kind of hoping that there was at some point a wool queen.
So what sort of, because I know Philly, the workshop of the world and leader in manufacturing and textiles, but what sort of like killed that dye industry here in Philadelphia?
It became global. I mean, you can do it cheaper and bigger, and it just got more diversified. Back in the day, when we were the workshop of the world, it was a concentration of lots of industries right in Philadelphia.
Right.
In fact, what's now Thomas Jefferson University, the Philadelphia University campus up in East Falls, was originally founded as a university to teach people the textile industry.
Yep.
And it just dissipated. There are some companies that are still around. Caledonian, which is up in Frankfurt, Torresdale area.
Yeah.
Kensington, actually. They're still multi-generational family business. They're still around,
but for the most part,
it's gone.
Well, the exhibit we'll say one more time for folks is called Bold: Color from Test Tube to Textile at the Science History Institute, and a great story about it up right now at whyy.org. via Peter Crimmins. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Coming up, why do people believe misinformation online? University of Delaware professor Danigal Young is here to talk about her new book, Wrong. Email us, studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We all know that misinformation is rampant on the internet. The wars in Israel and Ukraine, vaccines and COVID, climate change, every topic seems ripe for manipulation. And you can bet that with the 2024 presidential election this year, all the false news and information is going to get a whole lot worse.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
University of Delaware communications and political science professor Dana Young has a theory about why we believe all this false information. We want to believe the lies because they reinforce our identity, our connection to our group, and it gives us a sense of control over the world. It's all tied into our psychology, a psychology that politicians and the news media, we have to say, exploit for their gain. They want to magnify our differences, play up identity politics, and make us mad at one another.
Dana Young is with us in studio to talk about all of this and her new book, Wrong: How Media, Politics, and Identity Drive Our Appetite for Misinformation. Dana, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
And you listeners, you can call us, you can email us with your question or comment about the proliferation of false news and information. How do you recognize it? How do you think we should combat it? How do you talk to a friend or family member who believes a lie? Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org.
Oh, Dana, there's so much to get to here.
So much.
So it seems like there's kind of two parts to this conversation, and you really break it down in the book. The second part is like what's happening today. But the first part is what's happening in our brains that's been happening as long as we've had human brains that makes us want to sort of glom onto an identity and see the world through that identity lens. So let's talk first about that. David here has an email saying humans are social apes who, by their nature, look to those of high status for what to think and do. And I'll use that as a springboard. Let's talk about humans as animals here.
Yeah, David's right. We are social animals, and that's not just a throwaway line. That is literally because we cannot survive alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about what it means to understand the world around us, what it means to make sense of the world, how do we do that? On the one hand, we have information in our minds, and we can come to conclusions internally, right, through logic. And usually that's rooted in our values and beliefs, right? We also look out to the world around us and make observations of the world. And those observations of the world will maybe update the things that we know to be true. Mm-hmm. The issue is, when we make observations of the world, we're not doing so objectively, because the things we already believe are going to shape literally what we see. That's the concept of a confirmation bias, right? That we see the world in keeping with our pre-existing beliefs. What's underlying all of this, though, and what's fascinating to me is that there's increasing evidence that the values and theories and beliefs that we hold are very much tied to our sense that we are a member of a team.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we know that we have all different social identities. So I'm on a bunch of different teams. They're malleable, right? Mm-hmm. But increasingly in the U.S. context, there are these political mega identities that are dominating not just politics, but also culture, right? Like there's this sense that Republicans and Democrats drive different cars, listen to different music, have different avocations, and occupy different social spaces. And so those social identities dominate so much, and then they shape not only what we believe, but literally what we see.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. There's an amazing set of studies that came out of NYU where they looked at whether or not you could manipulate what social identity was salient in people's minds. And so, for example, they took people who were from the South and they did different manipulations. One condition, they were asked to write about what it meant to them to be Southern. And another condition, they were asked to write about something not related to their Southern identity. And then they had them eat or describe eating Southern foods, collard greens, grits, etc. In the condition where the Southern identity was made salient, the description of those foods was so much more positive because they were perceiving that, what we call an attitude object, the food, through the lens of social identity. The example that I give in the book, it's related to me. And, you know, I'm not from the South, so I can't talk about grits or collard greens. I don't even really know what they are, quite frankly. Right? But
deliciousness.
But I am from New Hampshire, and I'm from a rural area in New Hampshire. And there were wind turbines that were constructed on the top of the mountains up there. And a lot of the local folks from the area really do not like the wind turbines because they changed the landscape. It used to be really pristine, and now there are these big sort of industrial windmills, basically, that are up there. However, not only do I have an identity as someone from New Hampshire, I have an identity as someone who's an environmentalist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm not up there, I think of wind turbines as really good. And I literally see them as like progress and clean air and blue skies. But sometimes when I'm up in New Hampshire visiting my family, and I've been around the folks from the community, I see those turbines as like eyesores, like industrial or threat, right? Because they're going to harm tourism, perhaps, and they don't look nice. it really is wild. And I think if we really challenge ourselves, we can identify some of those instances where we have the same thing.
Interesting.
And so that sort of links to the next part of our conversation, because perfectly well-educated people, reasonable people, could be led to believe something that is clearly, or most people would say, would be false. How do we become susceptible to this, and tie that to this idea of us wanting to be on these teams? Because I just want, how do we go from, you know, we understand facts to be true, things to be true, to believing falsities?
Well, what's underlying a lot of our needs when we understand the world, so I talk about the three C's. We feel the need to comprehend the world, have control over it, and have community within it. But all of those needs are shaped by our social identity. We want to comprehend the world in keeping with other members of our team. We don't want to understand the world differently from our team, right? We want to control the world in ways that benefit my team, and we want to enact community in the same way that my team does. So the notion, you know, when that first comment from the email from David, the idea that we're social animals, think about how crucial it is, or would have been thousands of years ago, to be a member of a team and to be a good member of a team. What would have been more beneficial for you in that environment? Would it have been more beneficial for you to perhaps believe in something that was accurate, but that went against everyone in your tribe?
Now you're out in the wilderness by yourself.
Now you're by yourself, and you've made everybody mad. They don't want to protect you because you have gone against what they believe. Even if you're accurate in that perception, is that necessarily going to be more beneficial than being a good member of the team, believing what they believe, so that then they, who become your protective coalition, can help to protect you against threats in the world?
Yeah, you quote a social scientist in the book, Jonathan Haidt, who says the most groupish groups had an advantage over groups of selfish individuals. And so this is evolutionary on some level. I want to read an email here from Leah, who says, I realized when it comes down to it, it's not about politics and intelligence. What hooks people to fake news is fear, a fear that is so powerful that they refuse to fully understand it. If they don't ever examine what's behind their fear, it will turn into distrust and paranoia, and they will be drawn to stories that validate these feelings. Mm-hmm. The stories themselves don't have to make any sense. What role does fear play in shaping our teams?
Fear is such an interesting emotion, because I would actually say, I would be more specific and say it's the perception of threat.
Yes.
So fear and anger are both negative emotions, but they're actually quite different. And as much as we think of these things as fear-oriented, I actually think that they're more anger-oriented, because fear is an emotion that causes you to want to avoid things. Fear, when you think of fight or flight, fear causes us to want to flee, right? It is anger that is an approach emotion. So I think that the writer is correct, though, in the sense that perception of threat is what is igniting a lot of these patterns. And a lot of times those perceptions of threat are about threats of out-groups, threats of other potentially hostile groups who are here to take our way of life, threaten our social station, our sort of cultural or financial or social station. But the reason that that distinction is important between anger and fear is that a lot of these beliefs that are false beliefs about the threats posed by outgroups, for example. Think for example, of the Great Replacement Theory, which is, you know, the conspiracy theory that says that the idea of bringing people to the United States from other places is a plot of the left to dilute the electoral power of the right, right? That is a racist conspiracy theory, but it's also one that ignites anger. Anger is usually underneath conspiracy theories, not necessarily fear. It's anger, because there are you know, allegations of powerful people in the shadows operating to benefit themselves and harm others, and they're doing it in a way that is secret and that we'll never really know about. And that makes conspiracy theories awfully sticky, because you can never bring some information to bear that would say, oh, now this conspiracy theory is revealed to be false,
right?
Right, because they're what we call self-sealing. Because if you say, "Oh, here's this evidence that shows this is wrong," Well, okay, where'd you get that? Oh, from that source? Well, that's quote-unquote fake news.
That's what they want you to believe. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You see, they're in on it.
And I want to read this comment from Jerry from Westchester, who says, I don't trust the mainstream news. They lied about Vietnam, about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I find that my friends on Facebook are the most reliable. And so I want to flip to another conspiracy that I heard at the beginning of COVID related to, it was a racialized conspiracy theory where African-American people thought that they could not get COVID because of melanin in their skin. And there was this wide theory. And then, of course, once And we did stories on it trying to dispel this misinformation. Yeah. Then come to find out that community, of course, was hit very hard at the beginning of COVID just because people thought that this was true. How do people create? How does something like this spread? And you heard celebrities saying this, people saying this. And this was a group that you almost, if you disagreed, people would be like, what? Like, this is true. And it turned out to be something that was markedly wrong.
This is so challenging because sometimes conspiracies are real. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have, you know, the person who writes in and says, I don't trust the mainstream media because guess what? That caller is correct. The press was wrong on Vietnam. The press was wrong on weapons of mass destruction. They were quite complicit, mm-hmm. actually, in creating and perpetuating that falsehood. So there are pieces of misinformation that are spread from mainstream media that we then later learn to be false. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about that conspiracy theory related to COVID in the African-American community, mm-hmm. you're talking about a community of people that perceive that they have reason to not trust the medical community mm-hmm. because of actual conspiracies dating back decades. You know, you look at things like the Tuskegee studies, mm-hmm. et cetera, mm-hmm. related to syphilis, and the African-American members who were participants in that study who were not given antibiotics that would have cured the syphilis because it would have stopped the study from being able to go on. There are reasons in certain communities to have that lack of trust. The question is, how do we try to push through and say, as much as mm-hmm. your community has a reason mm-hmm. to have a lack of trust, we need you to listen and trust us now. So let me just say, one of the things that is fascinating is that the messaging on COVID, especially related to vaccines and masking, was actually quite successful in slowing the spread in the African-American community.
Yeah, and other communities, yeah.
Right? So kudos to you for covering that mm-hmm, issue, mm-hmm. for saying, look, you might feel that you have a reason to believe this, but you need to trust because the evidence, the empirical evidence is there. People are dying. When people are actually at risk, it's when you look at the data on beliefs about the COVID vaccine and beliefs and misinformation about the vaccine, I'm very pleased to report that by and large, the people most at risk of dying of COVID, that is older people, were significantly less likely to believe
they
those
felt
lies.
The immediacy
they
of the
felt
threat.
It yeah
yeah
exactly right.
So we're talking with Dana Young, who's a professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware, also the author of Wrong: How Media, Politics, and Identity Drive Our Appetite for Misinformation. You can join us by calling 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And I want to use this idea of teams. And I really like that, Dana, because I'm a sports fan.
I wondered if you'd like that, actually. I wondered.
And I see so many of these dynamics in sports fan communities. Now, it's more benign because they're just rooting for their teams. But one thing I've noticed, for instance, is that if anyone says anything negative about a Philadelphia Eagles player that seems unjust, that thing gets clipped from wherever it came from. And it circulates very quickly within the fan community online. And then the next day, someone says something, and that gets circulated again. And you get this overwhelming sense that everywhere, all the time, people are saying negative things about your favorite player or team. Mm-hmm. When in reality, they're clipping 15 seconds out of probably 3 hours of conversation, and most of it has nothing to do with your team. And the positive stuff also doesn't really get circulated very much. Talk about how that dynamic translates into the political and political identity world.
So what you're talking about is the intersection of the sort of logics and incentives of our media environment mm-hmm. and our natural social psychological tendencies. So you are not wrong that those are the very clips that are going viral. And it is because what drives the engine, especially on social media platforms, what drives the engine of virality is content that is emotional. And in the political realm, it's also moral yeah. and emotional content. If you feel that your team has been unfairly attacked.
Yeah.
Or if there's content that reminds you that your team is awesome.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Then either of those are going to ignite a little bit of a rush inside of us, and we'll be more likely to click on, well, depending upon what it is, an angry face or a happy face, yeah. or to share it or comment on it, or to share it and say, "Can you believe this? Look at these jerks. They're saying these things. It's not right." That is the content that is rewarded by the platforms. And remember, and this is essential, the economics of social media are contingent on their ability to get us to leave information about who we are for them.
Mm.
Okay? They cannot target us with micro-targeted advertisements if all we do is look at our news feed and not click anything.
They got to know what team we're on.
They need to know what makes us happy, what yeah. makes us mad, what we're going to write about. And every time we do that, we signal to them,
yep.
this is the content that they respond to and that we're going to incentivize.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Our teams used to be sort of, we used to be, and Avi and I were talking about this before the show, that we were all on these different teams, racial teams, religious teams, all of this. And now we seem to have been reconfigured to be on these two teams politically, liberal or conservative. How did we switch from being sort of able to rally around political ideas versus now rallying around political identities?
Yeah, crash course in U.S. history and history of the parties here, because it's really bananas.
Yeah.
So, you know, you probably have heard a lot of political scientists talking about political polarization, which is obviously part of this. But where political psychologists are looking now is at exactly what you're talking about, which is this phenomenon where it's not just about the political parties becoming more extreme. It's about how we think of ourselves as part of our political teams that's mm-hmm. become more pronounced. And the history dates back to the 1970s. So after the civil rights movement, there was a radical shift in how the political parties operated in the United States. And that shift was what we call the racial realignment of the parties, where you have as African Americans migrated to cities north and west, they sort of changed the politics of what it meant to be the Democratic Party, prioritizing civil rights and calling for civil rights legislation. Then you have the folks in the South who now you have Republican leaders in the South who now missing some of those people who or some of those folks who would have been on their side now because of differences of opinion on civil rights. They need to look at how they're going to up their numbers. And so they had what we call the Southern strategy, really, to sort of ignite different identities and unite those identities with what it meant to be a conservative Republican. Mm. And a lot of those identities had to do not only with approval of segregationist policies, but also an active effort to recruit evangelical Christians, white evangelical Christians, and activate this religious group that was really untapped because they never thought of themselves as sort of a political movement. It was bigger than a secular, you know, idea. It was really about like the afterlife. But now you're talking about activating this group here on earth towards a political end.
Mm.
And so we have what we call the social sorting of our parties over the last four decades, where different kinds of people became affiliated with the two parties. So we have two political parties that now are not just different on policy positions, but and actually sometimes not even that different. I'll come back to that. But are really different on who's in the parties.
Yeah. Well, I actually don't want to skip past what you were just about to talk mm-hmm. about, which is this idea that we have these political mega identities and we've sorted into these teams, even though our individual views might be very mm-hmm. complex mm-hmm. and might mm-hmm. cross over
yeah.
between the two teams. That's sort of it's hard to understand initially.
It is.
How do you explain it?
Well, in part, I explain it by the fact that you have, as much as these sort of political cultural identities are huge, right? People are not always in the weeds of public policy.
Right.
And if you look at what a lot of the news media is about, it's usually at about 30,000 feet in the culture war issues. It's not necessarily about details of gun legislation, for example.
Let's hold that thought. We're going to get back to Dana Young talking about misinformation in politics and how we got to where we are today. Stick with us. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt, and we are back here with Dana Gal Young, professor of communications and political science at the University of Delaware, and we're talking about why we believe things that we know are false and how that tendency gets used by politicians and the news media. Dana, you were kind of in the middle of the point there about how, like, we have these political mega identities. They're super powerful, and yet our personal beliefs sometimes don't quite fall into the ascribed camps. So I'll let you continue on that.
People are surprised to learn this, actually, that even on issues as controversial as abortion or gun control, when you look at even individuals who seem to have a pretty salient mega identity in keeping with the right or the left, you might find that their specific position on these issues is actually quite a bit more nuanced. You know, I'm looking right now with some colleagues of mine at the University of Delaware at what happens when people are exposed to information that only highlights the extremes of issue positions, right? When you hear the news media talk about abortion, for example, the pro-life and pro-choice positions are often framed at the poles, like at the extremes. When you ask people their opinion on these issues, there is a lot. I mean, it's complicated. There's a lot of nuance and caveats and under certain conditions, et cetera. But you would never know that from what these people look like based on their political identities. So that always gives me hope, because it suggests that you should always make a seat at the table and you should always be open to conversation, because even if you're looking at someone who looks like the poster child of someone who will disagree with you on everything, they might not.
Because it's a lot more nuanced there. And so I want to kind of pivot, because there's a lot of pieces to the process, right? And so I want to talk solutions a little bit. And we have a question from Henry from Bryn Mawr, who says, how can I best teach my parents not to fall victim to misinformation on Facebook and YouTube? You have all this information come in. How do you even sift through it, knowing that you do probably have a lot of nuanced opinions on things?
Henry, I really sympathize, because my parents are 85 years old and my mom's on Facebook. And it really is challenging. We know from some empirical work that it is older generations who are most susceptible to the information that they see online, the misinformation they see online. In part, it's because these are individuals who grew up at a time when information that came to us through a media outlet had been vetted, there were gatekeepers and producers and editors who decided that it could go on the air. And so I think that there's still that assumption that, like, I see it here, therefore it's true. Part of it is about media literacy and explaining that it's a very different time. It's a very different set of realities about how these platforms work. The one thing that I think is always helpful, and I talk to my students about it, and I try to teach in the classroom, is this concept of intellectual humility, which is that if we say, you know what, I'm never going to remove myself from doubt. I'm always going to be open to the possibility that my view might be incorrect. It's kind of the way that scientists go about their business, right? Where they come up with a theory, but they try to break it, right? They try to test it and falsify it. If we can talk to our loved ones about that as a way of approaching the world and model it and demonstrate it by being open ourselves and being humble ourselves, that is often helpful.
You mentioned older people are susceptible, of course, but we do have an email from Tricia, who's a college professor, who's wondering about a way to inoculate my students against conspiratorial thinking. So it does, you know, bridge the age groups. You talk in the book, I think some people's inclination here when it comes to misinformation is to do content moderation on mm-hmm. social media, to say this can't be posted, this can't be shared. You take a slightly different position, I think, which is more that we need transparency about how these social media platforms work as opposed to trying to do the whack-a-mole thing with every bad piece of information. So explain that position a little bit.
Part of that is also because if there's anything that a conspiracy theorist is going to become more conspiratorial about...
suppressed information, yeah.
It's information suppression. Yeah, so yeah, it's like, true. You know, how many times have you seen like, oh, you know, I had a post and it was removed. Yep. Can you explain that? Yeah. You know, like that is not going to get us where we need to go, especially because if you look at some of the upstream causes, which is why I have the book laid out, in terms of the people and the process. If you look upstream at the social psychological factors and the political factors that drive this, you could take down every piece of mis and disinformation and we would still be in quite a pickle, okay? Because there's always going to be more and it's always going to show up in different ways and there's always going to be new wacky things that are probably identity driven, that are in-group and out-group oriented, that are completely false, that people will come up with. So there's a couple things. If you look upstream at educating people about how it is that our brains actually work, what our motivations actually are, how these social identities and these mega identities are problematic and they're harmful. And yes, you feel that you are on the side of moral righteousness. However, they think that too.
Yeah.
And if we continue on that path, we're getting nowhere, number one. Number two, thinking about the notion that if you move downstream a little bit, thinking about not just intellectual humility, but actually changing how we perform our identities, mm-hmm. right? This is really challenging, by the way.
We're fighting human nature. This is tough.
It's so tough. But I'm such an optimist. It makes all of my social scientist friends crazy because social scientists are pessimists by design, but I am not. And I do think that people want democracy to succeed. I think that many people are tired of this bifurcated landscape that we're in. And because we now live in a world where we create the content that contributes to our media environment, we can change what we put out there, what we respond to, whether or not we decide to put more outrage content in the mm-hmm. mix, or model a kind of democratically minded humility that brings the temperature down across the board, because when we do, social identity becomes less salient and we're less likely to be driven by identity in our perception of the world.
And we only have a couple more minutes, but I got to ask you this. I mean, 2024, it's here, you know, a couple weeks from now, Iowa caucuses kick off. What do you see as being the biggest challenges coming forward and also the opportunities? And you have about a minute and a half or so.
Well, there's a Washington Post poll that came out today that showed that 25% of the American people think that the January 6th insurrection was an inside job by the FBI, which mm-hmm. now, because I'm an optimist, I also look at the fact that even though 44% of Trump supporters believe that lie, because mm-hmm. that is a lie, 20% of Trump supporters say that that is false. Mm-hmm. That, to me, it's in those little spaces where you say, okay, well, so this is an identity. This is a MAGA identity. But even it is not uniform. There is space. And when you look at some of the lies that surround the MAGA movement, you look at the election lie, it's about comprehension, control, and community. Mm-hmm. And the more we start talking to people about why do you need to comprehend things that way? What is it that you're looking to try to control? And reminding people, especially people that believe in lies, that you have a relationship with them as well. You are a loved one. You are a friend. You have shared experiences with them outside of this political mega identity that seems to have captured them. Mm-hmm. That is important. Do not isolate them. Do not mock them. Do not insult them, but embrace them.
Yeah. Call them in.
Call them in.
Interesting. And you mentioned, and we're wrapping up this conversation, and so many comments we couldn't get to. We apologize. Mm-hmm. Just a very fruitful conversation. But you know, in some ways, technology drove us to this place and the mm-hmm. fragmenting of the news media drove us yeah. to this place. But also in some ways, history drove us to this place. There was sort of a historical sorting that happened. And we don't know what history has in store for us over the next
exactly
20 years. There could be new teams, new identities that emerge out of some, you know, big reorganizing event. Yes. You just never know, right?
And there could be new media with new media logics
sure.
that don't require.
Don't exploit these exact same things.
Exactly, that don't require that we be split up and outraged.
We can hope.
We can hope.
That's
Thank
right.
you so much, Dana,
Thank
for
you.
Joining us today on Studio 2.
Thanks.
That is
Dana Young. You tell him.
That is Dana Young, professor of communications and political science at the University of Delaware and author of the new book, Wrong, How Media, Politics, and Identity Drive Our Appetite for Misinformation.
That does it. For Studio 2 today and this week. I'm off next week, by the way.
Oh, I'm going to miss you,
Avi. I am going to miss you guys. I'll be back the week after. You can follow Studio 2 on social media platforms. I don't know if we should say that now. Download the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's program. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Avi Wolf-Maneri.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much, friends, for joining us.